And for the next 2 hours, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. What will happen? As a matter of fact, the work is called Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. James Barrett joins us, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got a great couple hours for you. James Barrett, a long fascination with artificial intelligence, which came to a head in his life in 2000 when he interviewed inventor Ray Kurzweil, roboticist Rodney Brooks, sci-fi legend Arthur C. Clarke. Now, Kurzweil and Brooks were optimistic about a future they considered inevitable. Clarke was not so sure, saying, "I think it's just a matter of time before machines dominate mankind," he said. "Intelligence will win out." James Barrett has spent the last 13 years researching the future of mankind and robots. And James, is it a bright future for us, or should we pack up right now?
It's good to be here, George.
Thank you.
You know, the future is in our hands, but unless we make good decisions now, it will be in the machine's hands.
Well, in our final invention, you're really concerned about artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Well, my book is about trying to get people to understand that artificial intelligence is a dual-use technology. It's capable, and that's a technology that's capable of great good or great harm, like nuclear fission, you know.
Yeah.
Fission is the power behind nuclear power plants, and nuclear weapons. So we need to think of AI more like fission than like, you know, car manufacturing. It's not benign.
What makes these machines so intelligent? I mean, it just boggles my mind that through chips and computers, yeah, that they can make things that are so realistic, and they just, yeah, you know, they just keep getting better and better and better. How do they do that?
And you know, I'm despite the title of my book, I'm actually very, very I'm fascinated by artificial intelligence. I think it's an incredible technology, or set of technologies. Well, it's a bunch of there's a bunch of things that go into the secret sauce for AI. One is advances in computer chips. You know, Moore's law says computer chips get double in speed and half in price every 18 months, and that's been true since the 1960s. So computer chips are getting better. Software techniques are getting better. There's a new, right now, deep learning and artificial neural nets. Those are two software techniques, are making huge headway. And there's just a new way of thinking about artificial intelligence right now. So, and finally, the third component is big data. Big data is changing everything. So it's a bunch of things that have made this an especially important time for AI. It's a real AI revolution.
What made the big leap in computer knowledge when, you know, in the beginning, you know, they had the UNIVAC machines and all these these types of, I remember ribbons they put through, paper ribbons, yep, with information. What happened? How did this thing explode?
Well, the personal computer gave everything a giant jump start, and that was made possible by, again, the computer chip. You know, it used to be that you needed to make as many calculations as your cell phone, you needed a computer the size of a football field. As the components get smaller and faster, the computers can get smaller and faster. So now in our smartphones, we have more processing power than were on the computers on any of the Apollo missions.
That's right. That's right.
It's miniaturization, it's circuitry, but it's also software techniques. You know, people have been just writing better programs, and then it's the availability of big data. There's a giant economic wind propelling the development, you know, the whole IT landscape, the whole information technology landscape. We're automating so many things, and businesses pursue automation because it's cheaper than having humans do the work. So things are getting smaller and cheaper, and they're going to continue that way.
And as they get smaller, they get faster, don't they?
Yeah. Yes, there's been terrific advances in processing speed because of the advances in the CPU, or central processing unit. You know, right now they're making processors that are designed specifically for artificial intelligence. And what's that? What that's going to do is, when you ask your phone for directions, when you ask Siri, for example, for directions, the directions aren't found in your phone. It goes to a satellite, which goes to a data center, and they send the directions back to you.
Instantly.
And then, but it's going to be really instant when that AI-designed chip is in your smartphone. And anything you want, like when you're talking to Siri, when you're talking to any of the digital assistants, the information that they'll be able to access will come a whole lot faster. Any of the processes like navigation or object recognition or translation, all that will be faster. You know, simultaneous translation is coming up, so that you can be on Skype with someone in Russia, for example, or China, and your computer will translate what you're saying simultaneously, and it will translate what they're saying simultaneously.
That's remarkable. So in some cases, this kind of intelligence is pretty darn good, isn't it?
You know, it is, and that's why it's dual use. You know, it's in the short term, it's going to make our lives better. I mean, it's just really handy tools. Self-driving cars are going to make far fewer accidents on the highways.
Oh, gosh, that scares the heck out of me, James. I am opposed to self-driving trucks, because I don't want our truck drivers to lose their jobs.
That's right. You know, there are 5 million professional drivers in the United States. Truck drivers,
limo guys, everything, and women.
Yep. Yeah. Delivery people. All that's going to, unfortunately, they're going to be unemployed.
You see that coming. You feel that, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, every state right now is, they're passing legislation to allow self-driving cars and trucks on the road. And there's a giant, again, there's lobbyists in Washington working for the people making self-driving cars and computer technology that are making sure these laws get passed. It's going to happen. And then people who are professional drivers are going to have to figure out what else they can do.
What?
It's not just them. It's you know, there are 5 million bookkeepers, back office accounting operations people. They're all going to be unemployed. It's going to be factory workers. You know that story. I mean.
Oh yeah! Look what happened there.
Yeah, Foxconn, which is the biggest contract manufacturer of electronics in the world, they make the iPhone. They just bought 30,000 robots to replace 30,000 workers.
Oh, my God. And in the long run, it's cheaper to buy the robots, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In fact, an American manufacturer of robots, Rethink Robotics, has a robot named Baxter. And Baxter costs about $22,000, which is approximately what a minimum wage worker makes in a year. Except Baxter works around the clock. You know, he works three shifts instead of one shift.
Yeah, that's right. You can work him never, day in and day out.
Yeah, never takes vacation.
And doesn't whine and complain.
So, you know, unfortunately, that's why I say this is the downside. The downside in the short term is there's going to be huge, huge unemployment and economic disruption.
Can it be stopped?
AI and
is this going to stop at all, James?
It's not going to stop. You know, what we have to do is learn how to try and learn how to live with these repercussions. You know, automation and robotics and AI will create jobs, but the jury is out on whether they'll create enough jobs for all the people that they'll render jobless. So it's kind of a wait and see. I mean, you can't stop it.
The oldest board game ever made was 2,500 years ago in ancient China, called Go.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about that. You talk about how it is, it's computerized now, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is we've seen, Go is important because it's like chess. You know, chess used to be a model for intelligence. If you were a good chess player, you were considered smart. And to
right.
master chess, you had to be smart. So when Deep Blue, the IBM computer, beat Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion.
Who was a genius and still is.
Yeah, and still is. And he actually, you know, it's interesting, he uses a computer now. He plays with a computer, and they found, and this maybe offers a little bit of hope for us, they found that a computer and a really good chess player working together is better than any person and most computers alone.
Huh.
So, but
there's hope.
Maybe there's hope. Maybe that's a model for working together with technology. And that's the utopian side of this story. And then maybe we can get there. But what's interesting about Go is it's thousands of times more complex than even chess. And DeepMind, a company bought by Google, created a program called AlphaGo, and AlphaGo beat the world champions in Go. And then they created something called AlphaGo 2, or the next version of AlphaGo, AlphaGo 0. AlphaGo 0 beat the grandmasters without any instruction.
That's amazing.
Without looking at any games, it figured once it knew the rules of the game,
it figured it out on its own,
and it improved itself. It improved its own performance by basically playing against itself and trying different moves, and then rewarding itself. So it's a fascinating combination of neural networks, deep learning, and reinforcement learning, which are two different AI techniques.
How far are we ahead in this country compared to China or Russia?
Great question. You know, those are the three countries that are really in this intelligence arms race. China is right behind. The United States is in the lead. China is right behind, and then Russia. China has said it's part of its national plan is to dominate AI by 2030, which is scary because Vladimir Putin just said about 2 weeks ago that whoever controls AI controls the world, because he's thinking ahead to intelligent weapons.
That's right.
Armies of intelligent weapons, intelligent drones, intelligent battlefield robots, and he can perceive that future, and that future is coming right at us. So it's not we can think of it in one way as a battle among Amazon and Google and Facebook and Baidu and China and IBM. You can think of it as a fight for market share and for all the great products that AI creates, but in another sense, in a very real sense, as the president of Russia said, it's a question about world domination.
Three laws of robotics, of course, that Asimov came up with. A robot may not injure a human being or through inaction show a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings, except when such orders would conflict with the first law. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws. It's an amazing set of laws.
It is, but here's the secret behind Asimov's laws. He didn't really write them to address real-world problems. He wrote them to generate tension and conflict and fiction. If you pick up a copy of iRobot, that's the book that...
That's his book.
That's the first book that the three laws came out in. The whole book is a catalog of how the laws conflict. There's always a robot doing something that makes those laws collide, and that makes good stories. For example, in this one story called, I think it's called Runaround, a robot goes out and with some men on Mars to get some precious metal, but the robot can't pick up the metal because it will hurt him, and he can't let the people come near the metal because it will hurt them. So he ends up walking in a loop, and the humans have to rescue the robot. And this happens again and again throughout the book, where the laws conflict. They're not really good. They're not really good laws, and they point out a real problem, and that is how do you make robots and machines that are as smart as humans? How do you make them safe for humans?
And what do you mean by safe for humans?
Well, I mean, how do you create... We're going to reach a point in the next 20 or 30 years when we have human-level intelligence in a machine. And machines are going to be making more and more sensitive decisions. So there you are, George, in your self-driving car, and your car perceives an accident ahead. Does your car save you, the passenger, or does it save the people you might collide with? That's an ethical decision.
Mm-hmm. And who makes that decision? The robot?
The robot. So the question is, how do you make that robot safe? And these questions are going to be more and more important as we get more computers into security-sensitive situations like industrial control systems that run factories. We're going into an era of smart cities, and those smart cities will be automated, and they'll be run by artificial intelligence, but they have to be safe. You can't be turning up the heat in buildings to 400 degrees every day. There's all kinds of things we've got to be concerned about. But it turns out that programming safety into machines and telling them how exactly to value human life is very, very difficult. We have a hard time defining human life. You get a room full of people and you can get into a big argument really quickly about when human life begins. In different parts of the world, women and children don't have the same status as humans as men do.
Why are people so concerned that robots could become so dangerous?
Well, for one thing, we're weaponizing artificial intelligence and we're creating battlefield robots as fast as we can. And the most sought after, so there are 56 nations developing battlefield robots. The most sought after will be autonomous. They'll be able to make the kill decision without a human in the loop.
Mm. How will it know who's friend or foe?
Well, that's a very good question. That's exactly the kind of questions we need to be answering now. You know, there's a UN proposal to ban killer robots on battlefields. There's an organization called Stop Killer Robots. It's a big question. How do you tell friend from foe? How do you tell combatant from non-combatant? How do you tell civilian from soldier?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if the combatant, like ISIS, gets is not wearing a uniform, how do you know?
Yeah, but exactly. But has that ever stopped weapons manufacturers?
No.
No.
Of course not.
A bomb can't tell the difference between a civilian and an army. Even we have collateral damage, we call it. But with battlefield robots, it's going to be much more serious. And here's why your listeners need to get involved in this. You know how every county and police barracks has SWAT weapons now. They have armored personnel carriers and they have high-powered weapons. All those battlefield toys come home eventually.
Right.
If we see battlefield robots on the battlefield in the next five or six years, we're going to see them on our streets, a couple of years after that.
Will they be guarding the streets? What will they be doing?
Well, they'll be trying to be police. They'll be trying to be police. And whatever problems they have being soldiers, they'll bring home with them. This is the big question. Can we make them safe? Can we make them useful tools instead of very dangerous tools?
I assume robots run on batteries, right?
Well, for now they do, yeah. For now, yes.
If they ever, just take the battery out if they start to act up on us.
I suppose so, but until a robot tells you, hey, don't touch my battery.
That's a good point. We're going to come back, James, and talk more about artificial intelligence, your book, which came out a few years ago. It's called Our Final Invention. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. James Barrett with us as we talk about Our Final Invention. What led you to write the book a couple of years ago, Jim?
Well, I made a film years ago, and I interviewed a lot of tech luminaries, people like Ray Kurzweil, as you mentioned in the intro, and Rodney Brooks. And Kurzweil is a great inventor, and he's in charge of the Google Brain Project, which is trying to create a intelligence in a computer that's as smart as a human. Rodney Brooks is kind of our era's premier roboticist. he's responsible for the Roomba that some of your listeners might have.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Robot that vacuums the floor.
Little vacuum, that's right.
That
may be turned into a lawnmower, I hear.
Yeah, well, that would be great. I'd love it when it gets to be a lawnmower.
And let it go do the neighbor's grass, too. You know, just keep going.
Or maybe just get a couple of goats. But so I interviewed them, and everybody was very rosy about the future when we share the planet with machines that are as smart and then smarter than us. And they thought of it as just all pluses, all benefits. You know, computers and automation and robots will take all the work and relieve us from labor, and we'll just have leisure time. I also interviewed kind of a science fiction legend, Arthur C. Clarke,
Oh, he sure was. That must have been a great thrill for you.
It was. It was. I actually traveled to Sri Lanka, where he lived, to interview him. He got interested in diving as a scuba diver, one of the first scuba divers, recreational scuba divers, and he went to live in Sri Lanka so he could scuba dive all the time.
How about that? Yeah, I got my certification years ago, but I've not been to Sri Lanka, that's for sure.
Well, I got to say, there's better places to dive. They've kind of abused their reef system there.
Ah.
But he said to me something like this, we humans steer the future not because we're the fastest creature or the strongest creature, but because we are the most intelligent. And when we share the planet with something smarter than us, they will steer the future.
Hmm.
So I'd been pretty kind of intoxicated by the whole promise of AI until that, and it just planted a seed of doubt in my mind. So I began talking to people that make AI, and all of them agreed that AI would be, in the future, AI would be responsible for making the most important decisions in our lives. And so my question for them was, will that be a handover or a takeover? Will we give machines this responsibility because they make good decisions, or, you know, better decisions in some cases than we do, or will our volition be taken from us? And that got the ball rolling. A lot of people who make AI are very aware of this problem. You know, Bill Gates came out and said, in the short term, we're going to have a lot of really great benefits from AI. In the long term, we have to worry about whether or not we can control it.
That's right. Stephen Hawking's concerned about it. Elon Musk is concerned about it. I mean, and these people are geniuses.
Yeah, Steve Wozniak. A lot of the people that created the information technology landscape that we occupy now are saying, hey, you know, it looks good right now, but watch out when we have problems controlling it in the future. So when I wrote this, when this book came out in 2013, there were very few people that were thinking about it. Now you can't open a newspaper without someone saying, watch out what's happening. And, you know, what's happening isn't just all long-term stuff. I mean, as you've just noted, self-driving cars are coming up. Automation is replacing factory workers, or has replaced so many factory workers.
California police, L.A. police just approved use of drones.
Yeah. We're in the middle of an AI revolution. One way to measure that is just the money that's being spent and invested. You know, AI investment has doubled every year since 2009.
Well, then now that you bring up something interesting, James, and that is, why the investment for AI? What do they expect to get out of it? They're not making artificial intelligence because they want to look at a robot.
No.
Some people are. But
because they're
what do they want?
There are terrific and interesting products. Like think of digital assistants alone. Digital assistants is a huge market. Not just the digital assistant on your phone. You know, we're talking about Siri, Cortana, Google Assistant, Google Home is coming up to be in your house, Amazon Echo and Alexa. All these digital assistants, they're big business. And that's a great product. Self-driving cars, that's another product that people are going to clamor for.
Are we going to do, as humans, anything? I mean, are we going to clean around the house? Or are we going to ever drive our car? What are we going to do?
We're going to get plenty of exercise running away from the robots, I think.
Would you go to bed with a robot active in your house?
I thought you were going to ask me if I would go to bed with a robot.
Well, that may be another question down the line, because that's happening fast too, isn't it?
That is. It actually is. Believe it or not, the sex industry is on top of the robot explosion, and they're really planning on. There's actually, I found this out the other day. There's actually an organization that's got a name something like Women Against Sex Robots, and it's about. People worried about the future of gender relations.
It's kind of weird. I got to tell
weird.
You. Yeah, I mean, it's weird.
No. Well, so these are all products, and there's more. There's simultaneous translation coming up. There's navigation, smart homes. You know, everything in your house is going to be cognitized. Then this is a really interesting idea. Everything that's electric in your house intelligence will be added to that. So you have smart lights, smart heating.
Will somebody control that? I mean, will government one day say, look, you run your air conditioning too cold in the summer.
Yeah.
And we're gonna kick that up to 77 degrees. Will they do that to us?
You know, if they can, they will. The government just has a hard time keeping its nose out of every, you know.
That's right.
But what's more worrying is that if somebody knows that I turn on my heat and I turn on my lights at certain times and then I go away on a vacation and I turn everything down, they're going to know when my house is empty.
That's right.
And you know what? That handy Google or handy Amazon Alexa that's listening all the time to what I say, and say, Alexa, play this song, or
right.
give me directions, or answer this question. It's always listening, and that data gets collected and it gets stored away. And here's the scary part: somebody's listening and somebody's taking that data and selling it. You know, selling data is like a $5 billion a year industry. You may find yourself turned down for a bank loan because you're discussing finances, you know, in your own home. You may find that you're turned down for health insurance because you've been asking one of these search engines to look up, you know, symptoms for heart attacks. So
that's, you know, interesting.
Yeah, well, these digital assistants, again, this is a dual use technology. It's a double edged sword. You get great convenience, and you give away privacy. I mean, privacy is really going out the window with a lot of these.
Do you see it slowing down at all, James?
No, I actually see it speeding up.
I would think so too.
If you look at an exponential curve, there's this sort of elbow of the curve, and then everything goes straight up. We're in the straight up part right now. We're getting right into the straight up part. Things are getting a whole lot faster, and the rate of acceleration is getting faster for technology. So there are good sides. I mean, there are better medical diagnostics. The good side of self-driving cars is there probably won't be 30,000 traffic mortalities.
You sound like you're into these cars.
Well, I am. You know, I have a daughter, and she's 10, and I don't want her driving to college like I did. I mean, I had a 6-hour drive to college, and it was, you know, I wasn't the world's best driver when I was 18. I hate to admit it.
She might be.
She might be, but I'd rather have her just sit back and read a book and tell her car where to go. There's going to be a lot of benefits. We're not going to have these horrible. I drove past a car that was on fire beside.
I know those things. What if these things malfunction though? Then you're really up a creek.
They will, but I can't imagine they'd malfunction to the tune of 30,000 deaths a year. There'll be bad situations. There'll be people stranded in their cars. There'll be
no more DUIs, you know, right?
Right, right.
Can't drive drunk if you're in the back seat.
That's right. If you're already in the back seat on the floor, you can't drive drunk. There's going to be a lot of positives. You know, our ability to access information is just unparalleled in the history of our species. I mean, it's so easy to find the answer to anything. My kids and I are always converting things. You know, how many pounds is this? How many kilos is that? We convert currency. We do all kinds of stuff, and you can do it instantly just by asking. Not Siri so much, but Google Assistant is just very, very good at all kinds of answers to short questions.
We're with James Barrett as we talk about artificial intelligence. His book is called Our Final Invention. Do you see AI turning on us?
I see...
A violation of the rules.
Yeah, I do. I see that, you know, we anticipate that the things we make will be harmless. And then, but we're always getting kind of bitten by that. I see us developing more and more complex cognitive architectures, and then those architectures will demonstrate behaviors that we're not ready for. As I wrote in my book, a lot of AI theorists think about basic drives that advanced systems will develop. And they include things like self-protection, resource acquisition, resource preservation. They won't want to be turned off. They'll want to gather resources. And people can read more about this in Our Final Invention. But as we create intelligence that rivals our own, we shouldn't be surprised if that intelligence exhibits behaviors that are similar to ours. We're modeling a lot of the software and these cognitive architectures on our own brains. And our issue, I think, overall with technology is our innovation runs way ahead of our stewardship. So we develop chemical plants, and then we have a terrible accident that kills thousands of people, and we say, okay, we'll never put a chemical plant in the middle of a big city again. That's Bhopal, India.
Right. That was Dow, Dow Chemical.
That was Union Carbide, which then sold the subsidiary company and tried to wash their hands of it. We make mistakes like that all the time. Three Mile Island, Fukushima now. With complex systems, accidents follow. We need to develop artificial intelligence with people in mind, with ethics in mind from the ground up. We can't develop AI and then retrofit it to be safe. We have to develop it safely as we go, because we have such a bad history with technology.
I got to tell you, though, this is happening way too fast.
Well, I worry about the kind of world our kids will confront, and that's why I wrote my book, because I wanted I wrote it in language that anyone can understand, because I make documentary films. A lot of what we do in documentary films is take complex subjects and try to make them simple, and try to make them understandable. And so, I think the first step for me in this conversation is everybody should know about it, because everyone is going to be impacted by it. Both the good side and the bad side of artificial intelligence. So for me, getting the word out was the first job. But I think ultimately, as Elon Musk recently said, we're going to have to get regulation involved. We're going to have to get supervision involved. We have organizations like the IAEA, which is the International Atomic Energy Association, mm-hmm. supervising the development of nuclear fission. Whether it's weaponized or whether it's put into power plants, we're going to have to eventually come to create an organization like that for the development of artificial intelligence.
Are you concerned at all, James, that these machines, these robots, will turn on us?
I don't think we need to worry about individual robots turning on us. There's a really good book, by the way, called Robopocalypse. It's a novel about when the robots turn on us. But I don't see them having a unified kind of hive mind, and one day all the technology turns on us. I do see an AI race where we get more and more powerful cognitive architectures that run bigger and bigger operations, and I do see danger coming from one of those vast cognitive architectures. I see it developing behaviors that we can't anticipate. Between now and then, when we have an AI that may turn on us, we have a lot of smaller AI problems to address, and that includes autonomous battlefield robots and autonomous drones.
I mean, in some cases, AI is great. I mean, your microwave oven got artificial intelligence. Your dishwasher, it knows when to start and stop and heat. That's artificial intelligence. Some of these products are great, aren't they?
Yeah. As I said, and what's also fascinating about AI is, to develop AI, to develop, good smart programs, the scientists have to study psychology, they have to study neuroscience, how the brain works. They study logic and language. We have your computer understands you now. You speak and it understands you. That's an incredible accomplishment.
You can talk into your smartphone, and it will type out the text message for you.
Yes.
You don't have to type anymore.
Right, and these are great things. But what I find neat about that is that in many ways, artificial intelligence is the deepest look we've had at ourselves, because we're trying to recreate our superpowers, our human superpowers. We're trying to recreate them in machines. So we're digging deep into ourselves to find these things out. I think that's a very rewarding aspect of
it. It is. Now, also, let's say you go to France, you don't know how to speak French. Can't you speak into your phone and then it'll spit it out in French to those people?
Yes, I've done that, not in France, and I've done that, and I went to speak to a technology conference in Russia, and I was in Moscow, and I was in a park, and I was trying to find my way to this place where they made crafts, and I held Google Translate on my phone. I held it up to signs in Russian, and it translated them right on my screen.
It saw the verbiage.
Yes.
That's amazing. All right, stay with us for a second, Jim. We're going to hit the break. Coming back for our final hour, that means phone calls with you next.